I'm going to give a talk about the semi-classical approach to quantum spins, and I've been writing the outline of my talk. It really consists of 2.5 talks, and so I will beg your indulgence in squelching questions that are not germane to what I'm actually trying to say. I'm going to have a preview in my talk in which I say what I mean by semi-classics. The title is far too broad, particularly for this audience where many of the people know more than I do about semi-classical approaches. And I'll talk, the work, I should say, has particularly part two of this is based on the thesis of Paul Houle, a very good student who has abandoned physics. And rather than talk about the more formal parts of his work, I will talk about the specific application. So I have two systems to apply it to, each of which is a cluster of several spins. In the first of these cases, and I should say, it may be that my talk should have been titled A Quantum Spin Approach to Semi-Classics. The first talk is appropriate to the first title. That is, we're taking a system of interest to people who want to study a many-body quantum anti-Friedel magnet and using a semi-classical approach to learn something about it. The second part is a system of three spins with an anisotropic exchange interaction, and in that case, it's more like we're using this as a playground for ideas of dynamics theory and semi-classical quantization. I try to fit in a postscript, which I've thought about while at this workshop, about how you might realize in a genuine magnetic molecule interference between three tunneling paths, which you'll see come up as a sort of universal thing in this talk. So here on then to my preview. By semi-classics, I mean broadly when you learn about the eigenlevels of a system from knowing something about the classical limit, which of course is large S. This broad definition includes tunneling. In fact, it also includes all of spin wave theory. I'm not going to talk about spin wave theory. More narrowly, it might be situations where you relate classical trajectories to the quantum behavior, but I am certainly going to include tunneling in this talk. Some things that I'm not going to include in semi-classics are, for example, when people have known a long time, say from Haldane, they've used semi-classical ideas to make up field theories and to talk about things in some continuum limit. I'm not going to do that. I'm talking about discrete spins. And in general, reducing it to a handful of spins, either to two or to three, or four to three. And I'm also not going to talk about the simple case of tunneling between one level and another level of a molecule, which is realized in systems like manganese 12, which have been of interest here. Now, why do we want to do this? When I first started doing it, I guess I was interested in ways of understanding exact diagonalizations of extended spin systems, understanding the finite size behaviors, and maybe there was some better way to understand what was happening, what kind of symmetry breaking it was heading towards, than simply to take this small system as a bad version of the infinite system. I mean, you know, you can take correlation functions, but it's not going to help you very much in a system of only 30 sites or 32 sites. And so perhaps you can see something a little better, what kind of symmetry breaking it's doing. The second thing is just the idea that one wants to vindicate the correspondence principle. For me, this began when I was a student doing my thesis on spin glasses and modeling their dynamics by classical spins. And through a misreading, in fact, of the literature of spin glasses, I became interested in tunneling two-level systems. They talked about two-level systems, but they never thought of them as tunneling. And so one sort of wants to ask, how could one approach that? And and how does one, for some general non-collinear spin system, how does one relate the quantum states to one's pictures of having little vectors pointing in various directions in space? the of course, when one is going to play these the games of semi-classics, one wants to one often wants to compare the quantum and the classical. One of the things which is nice about spin systems is that when you want to exactly diagonalize it, the Hilbert space is discrete. In our case, for example, we had a the three-spin problem, we worked it with S equals 50, and so you can see that we're not talking about realistic systems right now, but this, we need this to see a clear-cut limit. And so when one uses the symmetries and divides it into sub-blocks, one has of the order of 10 to the 3 states per block, which is doable. Whereas, you know, when people study people, one of the industries of maybe at least 10 years ago was when people studied billiard systems, and they would look at the exact diagonalization, and then they would relate that to things like the classical closed orbits of the billiard system. And it's a lot harder because it's an infinite Hilbert space. I mean, people who know how to do it, of course, can do it, but I'm just saying you need to know some applied mathematics to do it right. Now, so I'm, at the moment, I'm simply going through a handful of general ideas which I'm going to apply in both of these systems, and then I'll talk about the specific systems. So here I talk about the classical equations of motion of a spin system, and again, I think you all know what these what it's like. You take the local field as the derivative of the Hamiltonian with respect to a single spin, and then the equation of motion is the group precess around that local field, and so if you had just a single spin with some kind of anisotropy energy, then it would trace out an orbit of constant energy on that. And of course, the thing about spin is that the components of a unit vector representing the spin are canonically conjugate to each other, or specifically the z component and the angle around it. And so the spin sphere, which is not analogous to the coordinate in a classical system, but it's rather it's the phase space. And so it's also true that it just simply doesn't make sense quantum mechanically to think of having a particular point on the sphere, and one is forced to think about things like coherent states in order to do something correct about it. But at the same time, you don't, it's, in my opinion, one of the approaches to things in spin systems is to simply say, let Sz be our coordinate, let phi be our momentum, write everything as a wave function in terms of Sz. And that's the most accurate method for calculating things like tunnelings. The reason why I don't like that is that that throws away the symmetry here. You know, in ordinary Hamiltonians, the kinetic energy, I mean, the momentum and the coordinate enter in quite different ways into the Hamiltonian. In a spin system, they enter in exactly the same way, and often there are symmetries relating them. So I want strongly to stick to a phase space picture in which I can visualize the sphere. Now, to talking of going into something about quantum mechanics, I mentioned coherent states. This is the usual definition of a coherent state as having the maximum projection along an arbitrary unit vector m, and then say the classic way, I guess, developed by people like Clouder to they write some kind of path integral, and it's very the derivation of this is rather fishy in my opinion for a spin system, but anyway. But it's really helpful in thinking about things in a quick and dirty way. If you don't really want to get the prefactors of some tunneling matrix element, but merely want to get the first impression of it, so you basically the phase factor, which is you have a which is up in the path integral, that has a term which is the Hamiltonian, and then it has a term which is nothing but the you know, which is the area in phase space. In other words, the spherical area traced out by the path. Or if you have many spins, the sum of all those spins of the areas that they're tracing out. And so multiplied by S, the length of that spin. And of course, along classical trajectories, the second term is just constant. And that will be the saddle point of that path integral. Now, just as a teaser, I will say here's a picture of a particular configuration which will actually appear in both, actually represent something that happens in both of my talks. Although in neither case will it be literally a spin phase sphere, but I'll get back to this picture. If you look at those of you who are thinking will recognize that there's in this picture there is a threefold symmetry around the axis here, and these are contours of constant energy and flows that would occur along there. And there's another maximum like this one in the back there. Those of you who are thinking will recognize that there's something wrong with this picture, which I'll explain when I get to it. Now, the two Hamiltonians to be discussed, let's see, I'll do them in order, I guess. The first part of the talk is the, which may be more relevant to the interest of people here, is the four sublattice system. I have a Hamiltonian on some lattice, anti-ferromagnetic, that connects nearest neighbors and also has a second neighbor coupling. And the second neighbor coupling is chosen so that on the lattice in question, you have a ground state with four sublattices. That is, you have on each sublattice, all the spins point the same way. And then some of these four spins adds up to zero. Now, it turns out there are many ways of doing that. And I guess, let's see, is now the time? Well, I might as well do it now. If you consider my legs, for example, with the joints as represented as four vectors, which add up to zero when my feet are held together, then if I can do motions like this to represent, here the four are pointing along the same axis, up or down. I can, if I stand like this, they are pointing roughly towards the corners of a tetrahedron, as equal, as far apart from each other in angle as possible, as non-collinear as possible, and those are inequivalent by any rotation, but they have the same energy according to this. I'll show you the bottom of this transparency later on. The other example is the three-spin Hamiltonian, which was actually studied originally back when people, the first paper that was studying the idea of quantum chaos in a spin system by Nakamura and Bishop. So one thing that people have done in the past, have done for spin systems, also Gerhard Mueller, is that they found a system which had a, classically had a chaotic regime, and then they looked in quantum mechanics, and then it is known that quantum chaos, I guess, is sort of defined that the eigenvalues are like those of a random matrix. And so there's repulsion between the eigenvalues. Levels don't cross each other. And so they verified that in the regime where the classical system was chaotic, the quantum system had this typical behavior of the eigenvalues. And this has been done in spin systems. But the other kinds of things which have been done in spin systems, which are to relate specific orbits to specific eigenvalues, had not been done before the thesis of Paul Hoole, basically. So I was just filling in that gap. Now, getting back to this particular system, the Hamiltonian then is, as I say, just three spins, symmetric, and the exchange has an easy plane exchange anisotropy. And so the minimum of this energy is occurring when the spins are pointing 120 degrees apart from each other in the easy plane. But I would like to point out that in this particular system, I'm not going to be interested just in the low energy states, but in all states in all ranges of energy. So really, I could just change the sign in front of this. All the eigenlevels would be the same, and then the ground state would be ferromagnetic. So I'm just saying that I'm going to talk about both the one end, the ferromagnetic end, and the anti-ferromagnetic end. And it's really better to use those terms than to worry about which sign I've chosen to put in front of this. Okay, is it clear the point I was just making? We're diagonalizing this and finding all the levels and doing things with that. And so this Hamiltonian, of course, has a symmetry around the z-axis. And so if I count the number of degrees of freedom that are non-trivial here, I start out having two for each spin. The number of coordinates, each degree of freedom having two coordinates. I subtract one for the total conservation of SZ, and then along with that, I subtract another because the angle around the z-axis is fairly trivial. The dynamics of the other degrees of freedom do not depend on the overall rotation around the z-axis. So the overall rotation around the z-axis does have a non-trivial dynamics, but it's slaved. It's a function of the other four coordinates. And so I'm left with four coordinates or 2 degrees of freedom, which is enough to allow chaos in the system, and it does have a chaotic regime, depending, of course, on the size of sigma. If sigma is equal to zero, there's a trivial solution to the eigenenergies, the isotropic case. Okay, so that's all for my introductions. Are there any questions at this point? Both of these systems will be quantum mechanical, but I will study them. I will use a classical starting point to study them from. If sigma is equal to zero, then the ground, then of course any singlet has is the ground state for this. But when sigma is not zero, it's more. But I'm not just interested in the ground state. Remember, I'm interested in both of these cases. My interest is in studying a whole bunch of eigenlevels and looking at the patterns of clustering and splittings or non-splittings between these, and seeing what one may learn about the system or maybe even predict about these semi-classical.
Something about the spin
waves? No. What, do you want me to say something about spin waves?
Or other excitations?
I mean, the systems that I have here, the three-spin system is, of course, just a three-spin system, so I don't know what you would mean by a spin wave. I'll talk about the harmonic excitations around the ground states, which are the analog for such a small system of spin waves. But I'm not going to be talking about wave vectors and things. So let's go and look at this four-sublattice system. The four-sublattice system, then, here is the, I told you this part, and then here are two of the examples. One of them is a triangular antiferal magnet when J2 over J1 are both negative and in the range 1/8 to 1, then you have this magnetic unit cell with four spins in it. That's what I meant by J1 and J2 if it wasn't clear. And in this lattice, as in all of the lattices that would do this, each, for example, a spin from sublattice 1 has two neighbors from each of the other three sublattices. So if I have it in the, well, you'll see in a moment, if I had it in the state where there are four sublattices, the energy would basically, the classical energy at least, would simply reduce to the sum of S alpha dot S, of M alpha dot M beta over all possible pairs of sublattices. There's an equal number of pairs from every pair of sublattices. They all talk to each other. The same thing is realized in the face-centered cubic antiferal magnet of the so-called type 1. And that's when you have a J2, which is positive. Classically, that will guarantee that your magnetic sublattices are the same as the simple cubic sublattices into which you can break up the FCC. I forget what the maximum range of J2 is. Probably anything. But anyway, this first one was the motivation for this first part of my talk. It was exactly diagonalized by Claire Louis-Lier's group in Paris a few years ago. And they found a bunch of low-lying singlets, which they partly explained but did not completely. They explained why they were low-lying, but they didn't explain which was which of those, basically. And I wanted to find out which was which of those low-lying singlets. Now,
this is a model which has a nail order.
Yes, all of these have nail order, even with spin a half.
But not three, four sublattice.
Yeah, these have a four sublattice order. The second one is there's some Danish people who have diagonalized this, and we're going to write a small paper with them as a sort of postscript to the other paper. So basically, the thing is, I'm going to take this extended system. It has 16 spins, 28 spins, 36 spins, whatever you want, and I'm going to map it down to a four-spin system, and then into something which looks a lot like a one-spin system, and then we can deal with it fairly trivially. So here's the first stage. We assume that these sublattices are so well ordered that you can approximate each one by one big spin of the maximum possible length. So I'm adding together, n over 4 spin a half to make up each of these sublattices. If I then substitute this assumption in, I'm doing some kind of a mean field theory. It's more or less the kind of mean field theory where you have infinite range interactions to everybody in the other sublattices. And you would get something of this format that you get a term which is, I guess I've skipped it. Maybe people don't, but I don't know. Many of you will be familiar with the fact that if I have the sum of Si dot sum of S alpha dot S beta over all pairs alpha and beta, then I can simply, if I simply take the sum of S alpha quantity and then that quantity squared, then all the cross terms will give me that first expression, and then what's left over will be the non-cross terms, which will in general be constant because the spin has a particular length. So basically, and that's what I have here. Here is the sum of all the four spins squared, and then the term on the right is the correction. And in order to minimize this, I simply have to make sure that each of these sublattices is indeed as long as possible, and I have to arrange that the total spin be zero. A net singlet, And there are many ways of building a singlet out of these. If the total length is not too small, there are many ways of adding them up to make a singlet, which are not really equivalent to each other. They're the analog of the classical degeneracy, which I told you about. Now, of course, there really are fluctuations within the sublattice. And so when we take these into account, we will split this big degeneracy. And my interest is in this talk is how that degeneracy is split. I'm going to be looking only at the singlet subspace, in fact, and I'm going to ask within that singlet subspace, how do these states get split by the terms arising from the fluctuations? And it turns out there's a very simple way that I can approximately parameterize that. And it's coming from work which I actually worked on this about 10 years ago on an exchange coupled system where you have some kind of non-trivial degeneracy that is it's not just an overall spin rotation. You can do things like you can add up the zero-point energy of spin waves in such a system. And it will be different depending, these classically degenerate states will, however, have different spectra of the spin waves. And so when you add up the zero-point energy, you may get different results, which is like a term which is small and of order relative 1 over s compared to the original energy, which will tend to break the degeneracy. You can also get these by a second-order perturbation theory. Anyway, the answer is always that there's a collinear tendency. The spins like, if there's a state within the classical degenerate manifold where all the spins are up or down along the same axis, that's the one that they prefer. That maximizes the gain from fluctuation. And so you can represent that by a term which is the sum over all pairs of these sublattices, alpha and beta, that goes up to 4, S alpha dot S beta squared. Obviously, that term will be optimized when S alpha is either parallel or anti-parallel.
So you're going to put that in by hand?
I'm going to put that in by hand. But if you want, I can cook up a way that I can, there is a systematic way that I can, it's some kind of uncontrolled second, it's a second order perturbation theory around this mean field theory, which is nice in the sense that it gives you something of this exact functional form. Or if you were to add up the spin waves in the way I said literally, you would get something which had the same symmetry as this, but it would really have some other terms which would be higher order in that. Okay, but so that's basically some sort of effective potential. It's biquadratic, so I call that H biquadratic. So now the game that we have to do is to solve four spins evolving under H biquadratic. Now I have four spins. I'm now going to show you how I reduce that to something which looks like one spin more or less. Okay, so I'm basically finding ways of throwing out degrees of freedom. Apart from this biquadratic term, the other energy is basically a constant because that only depended on the total spin, and I assumed that it was a singlet. So I have these classical coordinates. So sort of the starting point is I have four unit vectors, so I have eight coordinates. And however, of these, let's see, basically I have the eight coordinates, but I have a total singlet, so the sum of those adds up to zero, and I have overall SO3 rotations. That's three more angles. So I'm left with two non-trivial. There are really two non-trivial coordinates describing what goes on among these, and I'm looking for a way to separate those out from the rest. Now, it turns out that I already showed this before. The classical dynamics I also showed you where that comes from. Now, it turns out that there's a separation of variables. Basically, if I take any state, in other words, where four vectors add up to zero, I can take, I don't know if I should really take time to draw the picture or not. It depends on. I'm jumping back and forth between classical and quantum. I mean, quantum mechanically, I will be interested in honest-to-goodness singlets here. Classically, I'm going to be, so what I really am talking, if you really want to be precise classically, I'm going to talk about my coherent states, which will go into this problem, are things which I take by taking four spins classically, which add up to zero, concocting some ground state, and then summing up all possible rotations of it with the right phase factor. So, and that will, and that summing up is what projects it to be a quantum mechanical singlet. But I think if the four spins did not add up to zero classically, then when I did that averaging out, it would just cancel. Okay, so that's the connection there. So basically, if I have four spins which add up to zero, I can say take two of the spins, for example, and take their sum. It's pointing in some direction. That defines an axis. Call it the z-axis. And I have two others, which the other two define the same axis in the opposite direction. I could have chosen them in pairs in three different ways to play this game. And it's easy to show that the three axes you construct are orthogonal to each other when you play that game. So you can, in other words, you can construct a set of orthogonal axes such that spin one in those axes has coordinates, you know, n1, n2. One of them has coordinates minus x, minus y, minus z. Here's the one. This has coordinates x, y, z. Another one has coordinates x, minus y, minus z, and so forth, so that they all have the same components, but with plus and minus signs. If n1 was equal, and n2 and n3 were each equal to 1 over square root of 3, they would be pointing towards the corner of a tetrahedron, and, you know, aligned with the cubic axes. So I can represent an arbitrary state by taking this particular state and some rotation matrix, which rotates these three axes I defined to the canonical x, y, and z axes. Well, when you do that, if you follow through the dynamics, it turns out that the dynamics of this rotation matrix is trivial. It doesn't do anything. It stays in that. Once you have it this way, the symmetry is such that it evolves so that that doesn't go anywhere. The things which were, in other words, so the things which were equally, you know, say if N1 and N2 were pointing in opposite directions along, let's say, the z-axis, I forget which one it really is, then all their subsequent motions, they'll maintain that symmetrical relation to that axis. And so the dynamic separates, and the only interesting dynamics is coming from the remaining, from the dynamics of N1, N2, and N3, which is a unit which I can think of as a unit vector in some abstract space. It's now living on a single unit sphere. If you want, it's one particular one of these four vectors, because one of them is pointing in that direction.
Is there any argument why there should be just this right quadratic term? I mean, you have large spins, so there are higher powers, and there are products of four spins. In this instance, they are all
different. The philosophy is like the philosophy of Landau theory. It's the simplest term which has got the appropriate symmetry in it.
What about four spins? Four different. We have four.
If you consider the bottom line is, okay, the bottom line is that whatever I concoct from this has got to have symmetry. I haven't thought about all possible force-spin interactions, but if I were, let me actually show you in terms of N1, N2, and N. Let me, before I answer that question, I think I want to show what I get from that. I'm sorry. I'm going to postpone that question for another couple transparencies. But if I don't mention it before I'm leaving this, then remind me. So the classical orbits with this. Let's see. Maybe I'm sorry. I think I have. I didn't point out that when I substitute this change of variables into that, in terms of the new variables, this is what that biquadratic energy looks like. So in terms of the components N1, N2, and N3, it's simply the sum of the components to the fourth powers. That's exactly the same thing as a single spin in a cubic, in an anisotropy, local anisotropy field with cubic symmetry. It looks exactly like that. And the picture of that then is right here. Okay, those are the contours of it. So there's a minimum. This may be oriented the wrong. This, I think I like this orientation better. The I forgot which way that was supposed to go. Anyway, this is the right one. And so this is, for example, the x, y, and z directions, and the there are. minima here and maxima there. These minima and maxima, if I go back to the original spins and ask what this mapping, what they mean in terms of this mapping, basically there are minima which correspond to the collinear spin states. These are what I remember I said was the best ones, the low energy ones. The maxima correspond to the anti-collinear, the least collinear ones, which are, if you look at this, there's basically two ways, there are three ways of pairing up four spins to form two up and two down. And so there's a discrete symmetry breaking that's going on here. Okay, the symmetry breaking in this system of the ground states has a discrete threefoldness as well as an overall, the usual overall rotation. And then if I were, these tetrahedral states, they're not exactly the ground state of anything, but they are within this, if I limit myself to this set of singlet states that are, in which each sublattice is a line, which are the low energy states, then this is like the maximum energy. And there are two ways of doing this that are sort of chirally related. One is right-handed, one is left-handed. If you look at this picture, you actually may be a little confused because there are six of this kind of minima, of course, along the plus and minus axis. But what I haven't told you is that when I made the change of variables, there was actually an ambiguity. It turns out that on this sphere, I should identify all points that are related by a twofold rotation around the x, y, or z axis. So in other words, this octant up here is equivalent to the octant down there, and it's equivalent to a total. Basically, four of the octants are equivalent to each other, and then the other four equivalent to each other. Another way of saying it is, if you look at this upper octant on the picture here, that identify the meridian that goes from the point on the equator to the North Pole, with the same meridian going in the opposite direction toward the South Pole. Identify those lines. I do the same thing for the other such meridian on the other side. And you may amuse yourself by thinking about what this object is actually topologically equivalent to. I didn't realize it when I first looked at this, what the topology of that really was. So, in fact, there are really that only three of these are in equivalent, of the x, y, and z are in equivalent, and only two of the 1, 1, 1 directions are in equivalent. Now, I wanted to get back to the question which was asked by Dr. Mikeska, and that was about if I had some other kind of Hamiltonian. Now, I think the first thing which should be obvious is that if I still believe that the right thing to do is that the right answer is a four sublattice state, then any Hamiltonian I have that had the correct permutation symmetry to start with, right? And the lattice I started with, the symmetries of that lattice guarantee a permutation symmetry among the four sublattices has got to be there. So anything of that will lead to something which has got a cubic symmetry when I reduce it to this sphere. And that's why I'm saying that, although it's true that putting in these other terms in the Hamiltonian will change the shape of these contours on the sphere, they will not change qualitatively the fact that I have these minima and these maxima, that I have these tunneling paths. They will not change anything particularly qualitatively.
So the location will not change?
That's right, because they're determined by symmetry. They're all in special symmetry points. I don't know if that answers the question. I'm just saying that basically, as I say, I've chosen the simplest thing, which is allowed by symmetry. If I threw in other kinds of term, I would get out basically the same sort of result, but with different coefficients and quantitatively different. Yeah.
If you do this classical equation of motion, so look at the quantum mechanics commutative relation, then these higher order fluctuation terms will have to sort of correspond to some commutation. Do you not get time dependent constraints of the system? Do you do the correspondence right?
I'm confused. I really don't know what you mean by commutation relations.
This is a classical equation of motion. So somehow I would like to get, when you start with these fixed things, I'm fine. Now you add a fluctuation to it. That will offer through quantum mechanical system. And somehow I would like these fluctuations at every instant in time to have the correct commutation relation. So I can't just allow every fluctuation around this state. They would have some sort of restricted path. And how does that get in?
I think that the I'm not really trying, I guess I'm, remember, trying to directly understand the dynamics of the extended anti-ferromagnetic system. I'm working on the assumption that the sublattices are really, I'm working on the assumption that in the finite system that I have, that the main dynamic that's going to go on involves one sublattice that stays rigidly with itself, and that so that I can represent these fluctuations by an effective Hamiltonian. Now, what I'm saying, and once I represent by an effective Hamiltonian, of course, I don't have to worry because I have just the four spins. Now, I'm just saying, I think the question you're asking is basically, how valid is the reduction to an effective Hamiltonian? And I don't have, I could talk a little bit about, say, imagining a semi-classical treatment of all the spins together and talking about I thought a little bit about this, but I don't want to talk about it here because I don't have anything terribly useful to answer. But I can say a little bit. I could have said, but I will not, a little bit about how all the many different paths somehow add up to form an effective Hamiltonian. But I don't have anything very good to say about it. The proof is in the pudding in this case, I think. We'll see, when we look at the diagonalization, these things will come out very clearly. But, for example, I should say, you want to think about it. If you had a sufficiently large system that will have sort of spin wave fluctuations, you'll have things like tunneling that will, instead of the whole thing going uniformly, it will nucleate a domain where it has one discrete symmetry here, one discrete symmetry there, and that domain will then grow by quantum nucleation. So the fact that this is working is just due to the fact that I have a system which is not too big and not too small. But I think that the system where you see the quantum nucleation has to be very much bigger than the ones I've talked about. Well, let's see. I am, of course, a little behind. I'm up to 10 minutes behind schedule. Let me try to go a little bit further on this. So what I got to do now, having this classical equation of motion, I can do Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. There's a quantization condition that basically says that within each of these, maybe it's shown better here, that there's a discrete set of these orbits, the area enclosed, and within each of them is in some units of the, basically the area enclosed in there multiplied by the spin number s is some multiple of 2 pi. Actually, around these red ones, because of that special property that these things are really mapped 2 to 1 around here, it's actually a multiple of 4 pi, but that's totally right. So so I'm now left with a situation then where I have the Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization. So for example, for the low lying states, I've got an orbit around here, an equivalent orbit around there, equivalent orbit around there. I would say that then I would expect to have 3-fold degenerate levels at the low energy range and 2-fold degenerate levels at the high energy range of the states which are built from the 4 sublattices. The high energy, they're just the 2 minima. However, one has to worry about tunneling between these. And so when I tunnel between these, I will, I've probably screwed up a transparency or two here. But basically, there is a, now let's go back and look at the geometrical phase, e to the I phi. So there will also be, tunneling pad, which you can crudely think of as going into an imaginary, what one of these two coordinates is going imaginary, say, between this orbit, one of the orbits that I wrote around CX and the orbit I wrote around CZ, let's say. So from here to here, I have some kind of tunneling path. And on the right of this transparency, you see I have shown the total real part of the area enclosed by a set of 3 tunnelings. This is sort of, people talk about instantons. I'm not really thinking as precisely about instantons. And this would be a little funny because it's not just a one-dimensional thing involving two wells. But basically, the idea is that to have a sort of gauge invariant phase factor for this, I should look at a path that returns to itself. And so it's the area enclosed within here, which is easy to calculate because it's one quadrant of the total sphere minus the part from the sectors from these orbits, which were determined by the Bohr-Sommerfeld. So their areas in there are also quantized in the same way. So there's some, quantized area contained within these shaded areas, which tells me about the relative phases. And one can work out that one has these 3. It looks exactly like, say, hopping among of quantum mechanical particle around a ring of three sites, which is threaded by some flux. There's some relative phase factor due to that. Depending on what the flux is like, you can make the state degenerate or non-degenerate in various ways. And so in this case, it turns out that that for this tunneling, you always split them, but you sometimes split them one way, sometimes split the other way. And then for the other case, that is twofold degenerate wells that are in what I call T plus and T minus. T plus up here is actually equivalent to T plus down there by the equivalence I mentioned on this here. Then in that case, it turns out sometimes it splits and sometimes it doesn't. And so the generic picture that you expect on the left is like so. At the low energies, you have a triple composed of a 1 and a 2. The 2 are twofold degenerate. Then you have a 2 and a 1 and a 2, and so forth. At the high range, you have a 2, then a 1 and a 1. That is a twofold thing which has been just barely, which is split by a small tunnel splitting. Then a 2 and a 2. And so every third level, it repeats again. Amusingly enough, if I just look at the actual degeneracy, it's always 1, 2, 2, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, whichever of these two regimes I'm in. But the way in which they're clustered together is differently. If you look on the right, you see the actual numerical results for size 16 and 28 from the triangular antiferromagnet magnet. And you see that, in fact, this pattern is exactly observed. And I should add that the theory also predicts which way the first one splits. So that it should split into 1 and 2 for n equals 16 and 2 and 1 for n equals 28 and so forth. That's S. Large S, yeah. So that's really the end of that story. Yeah, I mean, the total length of the effective spins I'm using is proportional to the size of the lattice, of course. No. This is
because you're talking about four vectors
on the
way.
If you look back at the original Hamiltonian, I said that this was a case of on the triangular lattice, but it was with the funny Hamiltonian since the Nayel state has got four sublattices in it. It has a J2 which is competing with J1, so this destabilizes. If J2 was arbitrarily strong, you would have a triangular lattice of the second neighbors. If J2 was zero, you would have a triangular lattice of the first neighbors. In the intermediate regime, you have this first sublattice state.
You estimate that the main, when you couple with the regime where tunneling is uniform.
I don't know. No, I have not estimated. I don't have a guess. I mean, if you're going to have to, I'm saying the discrete domain walls that you have to make in the course of that are going to be pretty high energy costs, I would say. Well, okay, the energy is, yeah. You'll have to actually, I mean, to make such a domain wall, you actually have to violate the spin directions too, you know, which is the big energy here. I mean, the basic exchange energy, not just this chart that comes from fluctuation, but the basic exchange energy has to be violated along such a domain wall.
Well,
that's a relatively
low energy excitation. You have spin waves even in the system around these three points. So
the low energy excitations are tunnel split. The lowest energy excitation is the tunnel splitting. The ground state. It's exponentially small. Now, it's in true, it's an interesting, one of the interesting things I can say is that in the numerical calculations, the spin wave energies, of course, are going to be of order 1 over L in a two-dimensional system. They go to zero, yeah. And whereas the splitting between my first Bohr-Sommerfeld orbit and my second Bohr-Sommerfeld orbit goes to a constant. Nevertheless, in the actual system that they diagonalize, the spin wave is actually bigger. The L is too small. So I'm
just stupid to find that.
Yeah, what I'm saying is, the point I want to make is that doing this analytic analysis, which I have done, is a way of that I can tell them that, you know, that this state is going to go to zero and that state is not, which they would not at all be obvious if you just looked at the numerical results.
Yeah, they're finite size stuff. These states go to zero like 1 over L squared.
Your coefficient J is multiplied by 1 over L squared.
Which J?
In the Hamiltonian.
No, which J?
So, in your basic Hamiltonian, you had S total squared times some J.
Mm-hmm.
And J should go as 1 over S squared.
You mean just because of the normalization of S?
Yeah.
Probably, yes. The total
yeah.
energy goes as L squared, and the length the length S goes as, yeah.
So that's why these cases are actually only about the 1 over N or 1 over M squared, really. Whereas the spin wave is
No, I'm sorry. If you put in the factors of S that go in there, remember that in the spin waves, you're going to find that there's a constant gap of these Bohr-Sommerfeld states as L goes to infinity. They're optic modes basically of one sublattice relative to another. And you know, this, the funny thing about the system is that sort of this classical degeneracy means the optic modes get driven to zero frequency. But this is like a relative anisotropy of one of these sublattices coupling to another, which puts in the gap. If you don't believe me, I'll show you after the talk. I'm simply saying this is a fact.
Well, some of them, in the infinite system, if it has nil order, of course, there's an infinite number of ground states. But these are different in the future.
So, I mean, the coupling between these is.
The ground states, the usual Anderson picture was that the infinite number of ground states which make up the Nail state are things which have different values of total S. In this system, the analog of that that's for continuous symmetries. The analog of that when you have discrete symmetries is like the sums of the different relative phase factors between the wells. And those are like my three lowest states, which are tunnel split. So the things which are going as 1 over n in general, not 1 over, nothing to do with spin waves, but 1 over n in general for, as Anderson showed in the early 50s, the analog for discrete symmetries are things which are exponentially small splittings like these tunnel splittings.
You have continuous symmetries.
I have continuous rotational symmetries and I have these, but I have the tunnel splitting, discrete symmetries as well. The symmetry break of this system is both continuous and discrete. So from the discrete symmetries, I have the smallest splittings, which are all within the singlet sector. Now, I really want to say something about this whole other topic, because there's actually richer, although, as I say, perhaps less relevant behavior in the three-spin system. You've probably already forgotten what the three-spin system was, but I'll just flash it here. But basically, it's three spins with anisotropic easy plane exchange. Remind you about that I wrote in the board. I have sort of five topics. I won't have time to do justice to all of them. And some of them are similar to what I was talking about before. The first one then is to talk about what we could learn about the classical quantum correspondence in this system is more the emphasis here. So now it's not just Bohr-Sommerfeld quantization in low-lying states, but it's really looking at all the orbits and seeing what we can get from it. In particular, we were aiming at the Gutzwiller trace formula. Now, how many of you actually are sort of familiar with what this is about? Okay. Yeah. Well, that's probably what I would have. I got into somewhat accidentally. Anyhow. Well, it's basically saying a very crude way of saying it is that if you look at the quantum density, the density of states of the quantum system, that can have sort of as a function of energy, can have sort of long wavelength variations where it's more at some energy readers, less at others. And so that can be related to the shortest, the longest wavelength fluctuations of that can be related to the periods of the shortest orbits. Now, the formula actually says that the density of states is the sum over all the periodic orbits, some coefficient, and that coefficient depends on the Lyapunov exponent, so that the orbits which are like very long orbits that take a long time to get around will typically have a big divergence after you go around once, and so that will depress their weight in such a term, in case you're worrying about it. It also contains a phase factor, which is very important, the Mach law. And then up here in the F1, you have the action of the orbit, and then there's a smooth background, which is basically the classical density of states you would get, so-called Thomas Fermi term. Now, it's really hard to actually try to do this calculation, but you can. The simpler game is to invert it, and that's called the orbit spectrum. So let's say someone gave you the density of states. You do this, of course, by exact diagonalization. or if you're a chemist, you can actually do it from spectroscopy of molecules, which is wonderful.
You can find, you know, thousands of levels.
But we're not chemists. So you get the smooth density of states from the diagonalization, and then you can compute within a range of some energy. You try to represent this density of states as a sum of a few terms, each of which has got a period of oscillation. Of course, an oscillation in the energy domain, it means that the frequency of that is a time. And these times then should be the periods of the, it's like the derivative of the action with respect to energy, I guess. These are the periods of the classical orbits. And so there's actually, you can imagine doing this by Fourier transforming this. It's actually, there are better ways, because if you know that there's only a few terms in it, there's actually better ways called the autoregressive method of getting it. But you basically get a picture. Let me show you what this, I have a hand-waving explanation of the Gusmuller trace from. I think I'd better leave that to afterwards, like, know where it comes from. But this is where you are. Okay, at the top, what you see here on these plots, energy goes vertically, period goes horizontally. And as I said, all this was implemented by Paul Poole. I should say, you expect to see something. So these represent, for a given range and for a given classical energy, these are the periods of the orbits in that range. Now, of course, it's obvious that you should see many copies of it, because the orbit goes around once and then goes around again and goes around again. That's what these correspond to. You can also see that there's some indication here of these things bifurcating. And down here, where it looks sort of braided, that's probably an indication where there are two different periods which are so close together that they're not properly resolved by the autoregressive fitting. But basically, sometimes it seems two times, and sometimes it just sees one. And sort of beats against each other. Now, what goes at the bottom, what you're supposed to be impressed by is how similar this is to what's at the top. At the bottom, this is coming from a totally classical analysis of the classical dynamic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Geez. Of course, they depend on the window. I don't remember. I would rather look it up afterwards. It certainly. I would say it's certainly less than 1/10 of the whole range of energies. But I wouldn't promise more than that.
So what do you have to do? How do you choose the window size? What's the criteria?
Yeah. The criteria for this really was it looks good. You just sort of sit here, you turn the knobs of the window size and I guess the number of terms which go into your autoregressive fitting, and you're trying to look for something that comes out that looks sharp. So you could argue that this is maybe a little fishy. It's probably, so, I mean, let me point out that the thing which was attractive about this, since I may not have time at the end, I'm sure I won't, the thing which is attractive about this, at the beginning at least, was that this is a way of learning about excitations of a system while having absolutely no idea what their quantum numbers are. So the idea is you have this black box, all you know about it are the energy levels, and then you can go and sort of find out some well-defined semi-classical degrees of freedom within this. And, you know, so maybe these could be, you know, if you took a weird system, maybe these could be weird quasi-particles that don't have any charge and don't have any spin, that are have no projection on the things that you knew about.
Is this better than looking at energy levels which other people?
Well, better for what?
I'm learning about the level of quantum numbers.
I mean, looking at the energy level statistics, looking at the level repulsions does not tell you anything like this. It just tells you that you're in a chaotic regime or that you're not. It tells you statistical information.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
This is not statistical information. These are specific discrete orbits. You know, so this is giving you sort of discrete information about the geometry. And I should add that one thing we can post, which is probably not posted, I should say, you know, people have played these games, of course, with things like billiards, but they usually have played them with so-called scaling systems, as you change the energy, you don't really change the topology. In this case, when you change the energy, you change the topology of these orbits in a non-trivial way. And in the usual systems, that doesn't happen. somehow having a spin system where the natural topology of each, you know, of each degree of freedom is sort of, you know, closed. It's a sphere. It's not the usual thing. Makes a richer behavior here. I think a richer possibility of the geometry of the closed orbit. The bottom is actually harder than the top. The bottom is that you have to go, you integrate the classical equations of motion, and then you go and try to hunt for periodic orbits. And it's not that easy to find periodic orbits. You know, you can start by doing Poincaré sections in subspaces of high symmetry, and you start to find periodic orbits, and then you have to sort of trace these out. And I just add that along a fair amount of one of these orbits, it's all unstable all the way. So it sort of, it really wants to bifurcate into other things. And so it's sort of hard to sort of keep on the unstable orbit and trace it up and down here. But I should also say that unlike basically anyone else in this business, some of these things were discovered first in the quantum picture and then were later studied here. One of these three orbits, I think, was discovered first here and then later found as a classical.
What is that orbit?
Well, here are the pictures of the classical orbits. I guess I left that. This is the next part, the next subsection of this. You had a question.
Will make the resolution non-uniform in energy versus frequency. If you want to,
why not uniform?
Because with the Windows Fourier transform, we never have a complete resolution. You do like a Darboux transform, and you uncertainty will make in phase this is a non-uniform space-based volume.
I don't know what you mean by non-uniform.
That, yeah, when you look at this thing, and you look at the time frequency analysis of the signal, and you analyze it with a compact window, or you have a function that extends beyond that window, then depending on where you look at it, that finite window will give you different frequency content depending on where you are in time.
So you're just saying in
things
like aliasing effects and such.
Things like that, right.
Yeah.
And the thing to do, really, in these things, what people surely have done in sort of all these turbulent pictures, was to do with a continuous wave transport. So you picked up, you know how you've done it, but why?
Remember, let me just emphasize, this is not a Fourier transform that we did. It's not a Fourier transform, it's not a linear stuff. This is not an arbitrary choice of mine. In this particular case, the fact that it's an exponent, and this is, let me emphasize again, so this sum over k, okay, but it's a good opportunity to emphasize, the sum over k is not a sum over all k's in k space, it's a sum over maybe, you know, four or five k's, which in our particular case is the sum of three terms, which correspond to the three different classes of orbit that I have. At any given energy, I have three fundamental periodic orbits in this system. And so the sum here has just three terms.
Well, that comes out of your orbital gradient analysis.
That comes out, if you want, from the classical analysis. I'm simply saying the theory here says that this term, the sum, according to the theory, this is not a sum over all k. According to this theory, the sum over only a few k's, where k is not a Fourier index at all, right? K is just an index that labels different periodic orbits. And
in the reverse process,
families of orbits.
Yeah.
But in the reverse process, you don't know them.
Right, I don't know them, but I'm just saying that the spinning procedure, and I should certainly talk about this with you afterwards and not during this talk, is not to take a linear transformation of rho of E. That's all I'm saying. It's not a Fourier transform. If I took a Fourier transform, I would see nothing here. It would just be totally splotched out. And due to the fact of having, as you say, there would be an uncertainty in the location of each of those, which would be comparable to the inverse width of the window. And it would be totally, you couldn't see anything if you did that. You're using the fact, enormous use of the fact that you know ahead of time that there are only a few components, only a few frequency components that are present there. It's not a Fourier transform. It's like a fit. As I say, I'm not an expert in this. This is not essential to the physics of what I'm doing. I'm going to cut off this discussion because I have at least a couple more stories that I would like to talk to you. Someone asked what the orbits look like. This is a picture of them. I mean, it doesn't tell you that much, but I'm just saying it's really hard to represent orbits in three different spins when you're doing things in a correlated fashion.
Let's see, why is it more stable orbit?
I think that I cannot say anything useful about this picture, but a little later on I can say something about, there's a generic thing that can be said about orbits of systems which have a threefold symmetry where there are two degenerate spin waves at the lowest energies. And so I think that's actually on the next transparency. And it's closely related, to this picture which I showed you before. So let me talk about this. And this is an indication of why, you see, I'm finding, it turned out that the, let me show you a picture of the Poincaré section that comes from the three-spin problem. Here's a Poincaré section. God knows why it's in this reverse color, but it makes it look sort of great, doesn't it? So this thing is some kind of ellipsoid, and then around the backside, I think there's another one of these great red spot kind of things. On the backside of that, there's another one of these. So to understand better the topology of that, and also it really does have, the Poincaré section is chosen in a non-symmetric cut, but it really, there's a symmetry. It's really, this is a generic picture. So you have, so here you have a stable point at the north and south pole with orbits around it. You have three stable and then three around the equator, and then you have also three, what's the word? That, well, if you have, there's some kind of approximate, like Hamiltonian or invariant, which would label these things, and that would be a saddle point of that. These would be the minimum, these would be the maximum. Somehow this thing is generically arising, and I want to explain now what in this particular problem, what these coordinates actually, how they actually relate to the original spins, because it's non-trivial. By the way, did anyone figure out why this cannot be the Hamiltonian of a single spin? There's no anisotropy field which could lead to this kind of Hamiltonian. Okay. Well, it's on a later transparency, so. So here's the motion. Here's a very generic thing which has to do with things with threefold symmetries. Nothing particular to do with spin systems. In fact, that sphere which I showed you would result from the famous Heenan-Hiles problem, the very early problem studied by dynamics people. So you've got a Hamiltonian where there are two degenerate harmonic oscillators in the low energy limit. Now, in our case, that is correct, both in the ferromagnetic limit and the anti-ferromagnetic limit. In either case, you have it. And they are simply, because you have a spin wave, and you have a wave vector which is 2 pi over 3 or minus 2 pi over 3. It can go clockwise or counterclockwise around the ring of three spins, and they're degenerate with each other by symmetry. So you've got two momenta, two coordinates which go with these. Your Hamiltonian looks like this. It's been normalized in length so that they have the same coefficient. In the harmonic limit, I can parameterize the things the system can do. I basically have this harmonic oscillator can have any amplitude. This one can have another amplitude. And there's a relative phase between the two. And there's another relative phase, which is sort of the relative phase of the combined thing with respect to the rest of the world. And that's not very interesting. The relative phases are the things which will matter when I turn on the nonlinear terms of interaction between them. So basically, then, I can... here's a mapping. A new thing, capital PX, it's not a momentum, it's just, can be A1 squared minus A2 squared, and then PX plus ICZ, PY plus I, it's a funny direct, I use a funny axis to do this around, is A2 star A1. This is basically a 2-to-1 mapping of the four sphere of P1, P2, Q1, Q2 is being mapped in some, in some funny way onto a three sphere. And so the relative phase of the overall phase of this is just dropping out because of these are absolute squares. And so the relative phases are parameterized by Px, Py, and Pz. And that is the sphere which I showed you. And oddly enough, in this particular problem, when all is said and done, the symmetry axis of this sphere, not the x-axis, where I did the transformation around, but it's the z-axis. And as I said, the threefold symmetry around the z-axis represents not a spin rotation symmetry, but represents the permutation symmetry in the original problem. So in this problem, I believe that the z-axis represents the state where all the energy is in. Let me get that straight. No, it's not. It's actually a little crazier than that. And maybe I don't.
What
Yeah. I'm thinking about this Hamiltonian with some non, with some nonlinear perturbations. But. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm still in the middle of part two of the talk. It's related to the three spin problem. I said, you know, I have the three spins. They can lie ferromagnetically or anti-ferromagnetically. And with regard to the three sites, I can have a wave vector that's 2 pi over 3 or minus 2 pi over 3. And those are my degenerate harmonic oscillators, which are going in here. So basically, I'm just saying you have these things that are parameterized in this fashion. To harmonic order, I can parameterize the different relative phases and amplitudes by points in here. To harmonic order, it stays forever at one point. If I turn on the anharmonic terms, I have sort of this fast motion, which, as I say, it's not represented here at all. But there'll be a gradual sort of precession in which the parameters, the relative amplitudes, will be transferred from one oscillator to the other. The relative phase will change, which corresponds to a slow motion on this sphere. Anyway, this is so-called polyhedral phase sphere of Michael Kelman. It's been used to great profit in studying great chemical problems. But this particular one, with the threefold symmetry, has not appeared in this work. So I mean, if you have an anharmonic term, when the amplitude gets sufficiently small, you know, the rate of the precession always gets to be small compared to the fast motion, right? Because the anharmonic terms are always of higher order. You have a separation of time scales which gets bigger and better and better the smaller the amplitude is. Of course, in these systems, there's a quantization that the smallest amplitude is not zero, but as S gets larger, whatever, it gets better and better. I'm just saying to answer your question now, I hear the picture which shows which are the modes which are represented by these things. Basically, there are modes in which, for example, say, two spins are going this way, one spin is going the other way, and then there's other modes in which those correspond are like modes which are stationary waves, and then the traveling waves correspond to the points of the north hemisphere and the south. The north pole and the south hemisphere are the clockwise and counterclockwise traveling waves. I can't really say offhand why a particular one is better than the other. I can just say, however, that there are symmetry reasons why particular combinations of waves are likely to be stable points. So one of them is a combination where the three spins do the same thing but 120 degrees out of phase. There's another one where the two are doing this and one's going the opposite way back and forth. And these are sort of the characteristic special symmetry subspaces that were studied in which most of the periodic orbits lie. I'm doing pretty well. Don't have many more parts of this to show. So anyway, when we looked at the numerical results from this, we found, oddly enough, the same pattern of splitting. It's actually more complicated in one sense. Maybe it's nice to show now a picture of what it actually looks like. Here's the energies as a function of sigma. The sigma is the anisotropy constant. A vertical section of this is one particular system. And so when sigma is equal to zero, that's the isotropic case where the energy is nothing more than the total spin squared. And these things sort of group like that. And so you have... What you basically find is that there are clusterings which occur. The clusterings over here have really nothing to do with the clusterings here. This is the anti-ferromagnetic limit down here. And somewhere off to the top, which is not shown here, there's additional clusterings which happen near the ferromagnetic limit. There are three different limits here which clear-cut patterns of clusters are observed. The anti-ferromagnetic limit here, the isotropic limit here, and the ferromagnetic limit there. And they all have a lot of similar properties of having this 2-in-1 splitting. And I've given you the argument of why that happens. It's because you have this universal tendency where you have two degenerate oscillators and threefold symmetry. You always get this picture. And so this pattern of splitting is coming from this picture. And now, the teaser which I gave you before, this picture, the picture I showed you before is actually the same picture, you see. If I look at the thing which looks like a cubic symmetry, anisotropy picture before, and I identify this vertical meridian with that vertical meridian, identify the meridians together, patch them together, and I have basically two quadrants which are being sewn together. One of these quadrants corresponds to the northern hemisphere of that sphere. The other quadrant corresponds to the southern hemisphere.
And then you can see along the along what corresponds to the equator are these meridian lines which were marked out there. And you see that there are indeed three maxima and three saddle points along there, just as there are in this picture. So it's really the same equivalent picture in a hidden form, which was hidden by having this 4-to-1 mapping. The clustering pattern here, actually, this is within just one cluster. I have a whole bunch of clusters. Each one of these clusters would correspond to a particular level of those harmonic oscillators, which I told you I can break things up into. But then, so within each one of these clusters, I see an entire pattern, which is just like the, which is very much like the pattern of the of all the low-lying states of the four-spin system. And I won't talk in detail about this, partly because I don't understand. I have not done the work in this system to relate them specifically to the orbits and tunneling amplitudes and things, which was done in the other system. There's other things that can be said about, for example, the fact that this looks so much denser on one side than the other side. It turns out that there's a topological change in the ground state manifold along this axis. You know, that the ground state of the system is in the xy plane. Three spins 120 degrees apart. And there are two ways to do this. They're related by a mirror symmetry. And there's a barrier between them. And so states are tunnel split. These lines out here is actually two lines with an incredibly tiny energy difference between them. Whereas on the other side here, it's not tunnel split. And so you see twice as many lines on the top side of the dashed line as you see on the right side. That's why you see a qualitative, really a qualitative change in this picture as you cross this line, because the stuff is thicker up here. And it's not a topological change in the ground, in the not the ground state manifold really, but the energy surface, the set of states at a particular energy is connected together. Shall I flash it? Here's a picture of that topological change in some kind of section through the phase space. Like some kind of tropical fish that's being caught too, but it's moving into a four-dimensional space. So I've basically, it's not completely all that I have to say about the three-spin system, but it's certainly, I'm way over time, it's probably enough to say. I had basically, postscript, which I think I perhaps should leave for another discussion, is that I was thinking, well, let me just say that I was giving this to you twice as a riddle, and you didn't answer it. What's wrong with this picture with the threefold symmetry is that. Yeah. Okay. No, I know. It's really 2.5 o'clock. But each one of them, they give it at the Mars meeting anyway. What's wrong with this picture is that in a real system, the Hamiltonian has always got to have time reversal symmetry. It's got to have inversion symmetry. And this thing has these three maxima around the equator. It doesn't have inversion symmetry. So you cannot find any molecule which would realize this Hamiltonian. But I basically have realized that you can realize a very similar Hamiltonian that has SZ times something with threefold symmetry, which does satisfy time reversal symmetry. This is a generic thing that you would expect for molecules with threefold symmetry that don't have certain reflection planes. And in such a case, once you turn on a magnetic field, and this is exactly what is done in the experiments that Bernstorfer spoke about a few weeks ago here, you will see, he saw that as you turn on a magnetic field on the z-axis, this is the case you see where I have the two tunnelings, the two wells. It's a lot like iron 8 or manganese 12. It has two wells, but it has a different symmetry, and I'm looking for a situation where the amplitudes for tunneling that were observed by the experimentalists such as Bernstorfer, instead of having an alternation, which he observed, for these systems they would have a 1 every 3 periodicity. And I'm just saying how you would realize it. And you will realize it as soon as you turn on the field along the z-axis, which they always do, because that breaks the time reversal symmetry, and indeed it makes there be three tunneling paths. So my conclusions are that all this is, it's really not, I don't know how, don't know how useful all this is. The Horst Sommerfeld things in the geometrical phase worked out pretty well depending on the level. The orbit spectrum is not very generally useful. And I think that there might be some real systems that these sort of ideas would be useful for, but I'm not doing very much about it.
So thanks for your indulgence.
Well, actually, I mean, it just sort of occurred to me in the context of Bill supervising Frank, which is to think of an XY spin,
yeah,
large spin, the three of them in the next four. Maybe there are applications that are assistive in that context.
I'm sure that there are large molecule, you know, that there are going to be molecules. I mean, these molecules already tend to have subunits. These magnetic molecules have subunits that form spins. People have simply been ignoring the internal excitations of these molecules and just trying to treat them as one big spin. But I think that there are interesting things in finding molecules which will be better modeled as, you know, three or four or two large spins, and then I'm hoping that there will be some cases where a semi-classical analysis might be the best way of understanding them.
Yeah, what do you mean by that? You see that formula not being derived for spins? Consider the orbits for each spin and have the results.
Well, I mean, the way the Goodswiller trace formula is derived for particles, first of all, it's not a phase-space-based derivation. It treats, you know, it treats coordinates and momentum very differently. I think you have to count caustics and things to get the phase factors. But most of all, I think it depends intrinsically on having a continuous coordinate space. In the spin system, you really have discrete values of SZ for any particular spin. And I'm not sure that you can, I'm saying it means it's a different derivation. We were trying to do a phase-based derivation of this. Paul Wolf has written a big paper which does the ordinary particle system with a phase-based derivation, which is a new approach to it. But that thing is no good way that I know of generalizing it to a spin system. This is why I'm saying I think it's non-trivial.
Maybe
people are going, so I think the talk is over. What I don't. I don't know. Are you asking me? Okay. Let me go back and find that transparency. But what I don't know is, are you asking me a physical question about what is the meaning of the formula which I wrote, or are you asking me a numerical question about how does one accurately? Okay. So you're asking the numerical question, I think.
Well, I don't know what
question
I'm asking, but.
Well, I mean, physically, the statement is how from the periodic orbits you get. Sorry. It will take a while, I think, to get that.
I'm not a mathematician.
I'm still not clear. I mean, the assertion. Yeah.
Perhaps the connection between the formula and the picture.
Just wait a few seconds, and I will surely locate that. I think it was because I was already getting questions on it because it got out of sequence. There it is. So.
This is the function of E prime. Now you are writing it as a sum of periodic objects with the discrete set of k, and then some numerical values tau of it. And you are saying that as I change E prime, if the number of k is the same, but this tau k changes. Is that what you were saying?
Yes.
Okay. So normally I would have just closed my eyes and Fourier transform. You are saying it's not that easy.
If you Fourier,
so that's
if you,
what I call it, a gated Fourier.
Okay. If you do a gated Fourier transform, that's...
I meant gated, right? It's not gated. Guided, you are guided by something else.
I mean, it's what it's often, what you could do to analyze this is that, so, as I say, the, you know, I mean, this is the more, this is perhaps the more, the fundamental expression, right?
Uh-huh.
The thing is that you have this oscillate, this thing which is oscillating with energy, and it's sort of, so it's oscillating like that, but great, as the energy changes, the rate of oscillation is gradually changing.
So this tau k is changing.
In some window of energies, however, you could represent it like this.
Oh.
And so, in fact, you have something which is called a windowed Fourier transform, which is a real name, where you take a limited set within this window, you Fourier transform everything within this window, you find you find some stretching within that, then you do it in the next window. And the problem with that is that the oscillation, the period of this oscillation is not that much different from the width of the window.
Mm-hmm.
So how are you going to, so if you just do a brute force Fourier transform, you have a sort of uncertainty principle, which will just totally destroy the accuracy of what you're saying. Now, it turns out that there's, the fact is though that a brute force Fourier transforming is sort of assuming you have an arbitrary number of oscillating terms. It doesn't make any use of the fact that you know that you have only three of them. If you know that you only have only three of them, you could do something like, for example, some kind of nonlinear least square fitting. You could imagine doing a nonlinear least square fitting where you have an arbitrary coefficient here, an arbitrary period that you have six parameters then. What's actually done is a little different from that, but I'm just saying it's using this information in the same fashion.
Too many things, yeah. Slowly make it.
Yeah.